Hello, welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host today. And I want to introduce you to a podcast guest listener who's been on before, but this time she's coming back with a research publication that she's been working on. And it's about reading comprehension. And to be particular, it's about pronouns. And you know, I had to look up what a pronoun actually was because I'm dyslexic. I'm like, what are those things again? It's that, it, you know, when you say, you know, it was doing this or they or whatever, you know, so you replace the name of the person with an it or a they or a them. And talking about how with dyslexia, that can sometimes lead to tripping you up and your comprehension. I'm not quite sure what she's going to share, to be quite honest. I'll maybe give you a summary later on, but let's get straight stuck in and speak to Lois Letchford and find out about reading comprehension and pronouns. Lois, it's great to have you back on.
Darius, I'm delighted to be here and share about this paper in particular.
So what's this paper about? Give us a quick overview of what it's all about so that the listeners can see whether they want to hear more about it or not.
The title of the academic paper is Beyond Word Decoding, Little Words and Their Complex Meaning, Pronoun Resolution Fosters Comprehension.
All right, so break that down for us. So beyond, take each phrase and break it down for me, please.
Beyond Word Decoding. So when we decode words, decoding words is one component of reading.
Yes. And we talked about that in the last episode where I think, I'm not quite sure, 109 or 100 and something like that, where decode, what we often find as dyslexia tutors is the child learns to read and they're reading the exact words, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that leads directly or automatically to reading comprehension. There's often other steps involved. Okay, got you.
That's exactly right. And the little words, so the little words we're talking about are he, she, they, them, it, her, etc., 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 because they are relatively easy words to decode.
Yes.
And we make assumptions that he is a boy, she will be a girl, they is a group, and it, well, and I think somewhere way back in my mind, I have someone saying to me, it is nothing. Don't worry about it. Just decode the word. Just read it. And that is actually quite disastrous. And what happened? Okay, so that's number one.
Okay.
And how these words foster comprehension. What happened when I first started to teach, I had a lot of kids, large groups, a mess. But with one group of three children, I read them this book called R Said Stork by Gerald Rose. Very simple book. It's written for children who are 1 year old.
Oh, really?
Yeah. R Said Stork. So it's it's a picture book. R Said Stork, I will peck this egg. I will eat this egg. He pecked at it, but it would not break. And now I'm turning the page. And we've got a double page spread, I'll let you see it, of
a hippopotamus. Okay.
Hippopotamus rolled on it.
Oh, and what's that? A lion.
Lion bit it.
Monkey.
Chimp. Chimp hit it.
Elephant.
Stamped on it.
Rhino.
Rhinoceros sat on it.
Snake.
Squeezed it.
Zebra.
Kicked it high in the sky. Kicked it, rather. And?
Flamingo.
Flamingo flew high in the sky with it and dropped it on the hard ground and still it would not break. And the story goes on and on and on. And finally, you know, it bursts open and out pops a grinning new crocodile. Snapping his sharp white teeth, the animals took one look and fled and said, I thought it was a bad egg, said Stork as he went. And just wait till I've grown, said the little crocodile. And he slipped into the water to join his brothers and sisters. And that's the book I read to my students. And I went back to the beginning, to the front page, and I said to my three students, all three of them, and I said, well, what's the it? All three of my students who are now eight in the third grade of school put up their hands and said, it is nothing.
Okay.
And I was shocked because I couldn't believe, you know, in this book, there are three words and four words on a page. And they said, it is nothing. Why are these kids not reading? It's beyond the teaching of decoding. They have failed to work out that it is a meaningful word and you as a reader have to do something. Okay. Adding to this complication, I grew up reading words I could not comprehend, like these kids. And it set me on a search to say, what's happening with the reading process? Why do we have to do these things? What else do we have to do to teach children to read?
And to be particular, to understand what they read.
Understand what they read.
Yeah, because there's reading and then there's understanding what you read, and there's different depths to which you understand what you read. And this is the realm of comprehension. And I think sometimes parents with children with dyslexia assume that once the child learns how to read, then it's a job done, you know, and you don't realize that dyslexia is a way of thinking, a different way of thinking. It's often a more critical way of thinking, critical thinking, you know, but it's also a manual way of thinking. So sometimes that assumption that, oh, we all know what it is that the stork's doing or the rhino's doing to it. And sometimes we need to keep reminding ourselves, what is it again? Oh yeah, it's an egg. And I had to do that while that was happening, because I was like, oh, what's it? It, and you realize that you're constantly having to reprocess what it is. Whereas other people have decided what it is, and then that's it all the way through. Got it. But I have to reprocess it every time. And I have to be very intentional about, okay, what's it again? Oh yeah, what's it again? Oh yeah, what's it again? It's a working memory issue as well as a processing issue. So yeah, it's fascinating narrowing down on these pronouns. Now I can say pronoun and know what it means. Because actually it's interesting, because pronoun, I'm like, yeah, whatever. But now pronoun is meaningful to me because of your little research paper, because I've got something meaningful to attach to what pronoun is.
I'll add a complication. Do you want it or not?
Yeah, go for it.
When you go to the academic literature and you search pronouns, it doesn't come up. The word they use in academic literature is anaphore or anaphoric resolution.
I know, I saw that in your paper and I'm like, what's this anaphore thing? Why? Is this another version of a pronoun or whatever? And I'm like, oh gosh, thanks. That explains. Anaphore.
Yeah. And I, when I read it, I was astonished at the level of the discussion on things called anaphores, because it's not only, you know, we think of a pronoun as a replacement for a noun, and that's the simplified form, but they talked about the anaphore as being whether you're referring back to a word or whether you're referring forward to a word, and there were four different types of anaphores.
Oh, what are they?
I can't remember.
Oh, right, okay.
But it was just, you know, the level that the people in the academic literature go to is really quite different to what we need.
All right, so Lois, give me the punchline from the report. You know, what was your conclusion? What were your observations?
The punchline is, when children read words, we expect them to comprehend it. The reality is they often don't. And what a pronoun does is it replaces the noun. And it is really critical that as you go through a paragraph that you are able to understand who is talking and what's happening by the resolution of those pronouns. Because what happens is you'll start with the person's name and it will change throughout the paragraph. And they're calling it text cohesion. Are they able to understand at the beginning of the paragraph and at the end of the paragraph and get every sentence in between? And I'm not getting the main idea. I'm getting the comprehension of each sentence within the paragraph. The big deal about pronouns is when you're a little person, the distance between the pronoun and the antecedent, the one it's referring to, is very close. As language becomes more complicated, the distance between the pronoun and its antecedent, either forward or backwards, gets further and further apart, takes more work in memory, takes more comprehension.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I read, I comprehend well. I've read probably 500 to 1,000 books in my life. But I still have to be very intentional about it. And it's interesting because I hear it in conversations too. So my wife is saying something, and she's saying it and they and he. And I actually have to sometimes interrupt her and say, I'm really sorry, but could you tell me who he is or it is again? And she goes, oh, well, it's this. And I'm like, oh, right, I get what you're saying. And I've, in the past, I would just let it go until I eventually kind of figured it out. But I am spending so much time trying to figure it out that I'm not catching what she's actually saying. And so I end up coming across like I'm not listening. So I've now done the maths and I've said, Joe, my wife, I don't want to be rude, but who, what is he and what is it? And often a lot of people are quite lazy with its and he's and they's and so on. And, you know, you're like, they? And the interesting thing with dyslexia is because with dyslexia, you're often a wider angled thinker, you're looking at wider context all the time. So there's a lot more he's and they's and she's and it's and things in their mind that when you say it and they, you might be zooming in on it. You're making assumptions. They're not. They're like, hold on a minute. I've got to put this into context. And you've not clarified the context for me.
You just said the words. We're making assumptions.
Yes.
And we make assumptions when children read that if they decode the word accurately, they have the comprehension.
That's true. And so it, this affects you as an adult with yes. dyslexia, even if you're a very competent reader like me, yes. and as a very young child where I was an incompetent reader and others who can't read, all the way through. Now, what's the answer is the key question here, okay? And I've got something to contribute on this, and that's, tell me what you think, Lois, about this as an idea.
The answer is at the beginning of reading, we teach children, we actually model it. It should be modeled in first and second and third. It should be modeled across the board.
What's it?
What's it?
What's it? What yeah. It should be modeled. What are you yeah. regarding as it?
Yes. And, you know, take a paragraph from any text that you're reading.
Okay.
And have a teacher model it. This is what I'm doing when I'm thinking. I'm replacing every pronoun in this paragraph with its appropriate.
Oh, I see. Got you. So you're kind of modeling the thinking process that you're doing while you're reading. You're not just reading the words, but when I read it, I think about what it is and go backwards, and the child goes, oh, I'll do the same.
That's right.
Okay.
That's one that can be done across the board.
Okay.
And then, you know, explicitly do it. Circle, have an exercise where you circle the pronoun and then put an arrow to its antecedent.
Oh, I see. Love it. Yes.
And that way, then you can rewrite the whole text with the appropriate antecedents.
Okay.
They're really the two main things. You know, once you do it, the child goes, ah, it's a light bulb moment.
It's actually an executive functioning element as well, because in terms of executive functioning skill, sometimes if you've got an executive functioning difference or deficit, you know, you don't automatically make assumptions like, oh, I've learned this skill in this area and therefore I'm going to do it in that area. Often you just need to say the word, by the way, you've learned how to do it in this area. Why don't you do it there? And they go, oh, my goodness, yes. And that's an executive functioning bridge. And you have to be intentional about making those bridges.
That's exactly right.
I've got an idea for you here, Lois.
Yes.
So when we're teaching children mind mapping.
Yeah.
And we're teaching them how to visualize what they're reading, visualize what they're learning in a map, in a network, a web. Often they just write lots of words. And sometimes what I notice is they write lots of words in a line, and then they keep writing lots of words in a line. It looks like a web, but it's actually just lots of lines of text. And that tells me that the child doesn't actually understand what they're learning.
Yeah.
And so the temptation is just to keep writing tons of notes. Now, this is a bit more advanced from where you're at, Lois,
yes,
in terms of reading comprehension, but it's still that sort of theme carries on into when you're 9, 13, 15, 17, and you're taking notes. And here's what I do. I say to them, and in this example, it, okay? I would ask them, what does it look like?
Yes, 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 yes.
And immediately what you're doing is you're activating their actual innate abilities, which is often more visual or spatial or dynamic or multisensories. And so in that story about the different animals kicking and doing things to it, you would say, what does it look like? And instead of them asking, what is it? You would say, well, it looks like it looks a bit like an egg.
Yeah.
And it's probably blue. And it's very big. And then they've immediately not just connected it, but visualized it. And the moment they visualize it, they're starting to connect what they're seeing into a meta picture. And that's where real comprehension comes, once you lift it up to this level of seeing what you're reading or seeing what you're thinking.
I use drama with this story. You then have the person, the child, reading the part, acting it out.
Okay.
And it's a stepping stone to visualization.
Yes. So the drama would be, and they would see the egg right at the beginning and be holding the egg, and then, you know, and they could imagine it. Yes.
Fantastic. You're right. It's that visualization that we're good at, but you need a stepping stone to get to it
for
reading and writing.
And it needs to be intentional.
Yes.
And manual. You know, the whole thing about manual thinking or automatic thinking, and how dyslexia often can be categorized as being more of a manual processor rather than an automatic processor. You have to, in many ways, as a person with dyslexia, you have to grow up faster than everyone else in terms of taking responsibility for your own personal education. For many people, that responsibility happens when they're like 15 or 16 in high school. But with dyslexia, you have to take personal responsibility of it much earlier in order to succeed in education. And part of that personal responsibility is to start asking yourself those kind of questions like, oh, what does it look like? Or what does he look like? Or what does she look like? You know, because there might be lots of she's or he's in the story, you know, and the moment you start intentionally activating your own imagination to it, you're not waiting for someone else to do it or the teacher to say, let's act it out or let's do this or whatever. You start taking personal responsibility for activating that. Then you take more, you have more agency, you have more choice, you're not a dependent on other people doing things for you. You start learning to do it and unlocking the meaning in things.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. You have to take responsibility for it. Because again, it goes back to other people making assumptions that you can't make or don't make. So we have to, you know, keep peppering. What's the visualization? What are we visualizing? And see, there are words that don't even come out in classrooms, because the vast majority, 50% of kids get it. And what I noticed when I was teaching, when you read a book and say, what's the picture in your mind to students, the best readers, the most skilled readers come out with the best picture.
Okay.
And the lowest readers have like a stick figure. And it's detrimental to their reading and their comprehension and decoding. It impacts everything.
Like, I mean, I don't teach reading and I don't teach reading comprehension. So I'm kind of coming from a slightly older age range where I'm teaching them reading comprehension of a question in an exam. And so you see this in a question in an exam, for example, one sentence long, and questions are formulated with lots of pronouns, you know. The Battle of Hastings in 1066, compare and contrast how the kings prepared for the battle and what they did to prepare, and who was, in your opinion, the most successful warrior, you know? And so you have to go through that question and break it down and figure out they and who and so on. And what I notice, and so many teachers notice with dyslexia, often we get the wrong end of the stick when it comes to a question.
Yeah.
And this is a really troublesome issue, because a child can give the most eloquent, accurate, detailed example answer, but it's not the answer to the question you asked. It's the answer to the question they thought you were asking, but it wasn't the question you asked. And so they probably only cover about a tenth of the question you actually asked, and they only get a tenth of the marks. And so they've got to learn how to fire the arrow of the answer to hit the target of the question, but they have to actually be able to see and calibrate to what that question is. And often that comes down to really careful underlining of key words and ideas in the question, not just what teachers say, read the question over three times. No, that is not good enough. You have to underline the question three times and identify what the core ideas and questions are, and maybe even reorganize it in a way that you need visually, so that you can really zoom your mind in. What's your thoughts on that, Lois?
Absolutely perfect. Because you're right, it's the question, and it's creating a picture and answering the question that they want answered, not what you think they want answered. And that's the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's no taking the guesswork out, you know. Yes. You don't need to guess. You don't need to take a shotgun out and start shooting as many different targets in the air to hopefully hit something. You can be a sniper with dyslexia. You know, you can find out what the question is. You can find out what the person really wants and answer it.
But it's like, it's what you're doing, isn't it? It's giving the people like me skills to do those things, which I wasn't given when I was in school, which I needed.
Yes. So when you say people like me, you are really referring to a teacher who is teaching reading.
But even your answering of the question, this is the question, you know, to visualize what are they asking? Because I can see me as a child doing exactly what you said. You give a big long answer and it's not the question they're asking. That's most likely what I did, you know, throughout school. And it comes out then with the problem, well, you think you're not very smart.
Yeah, they think you're not very smart, but also it could go the other way. It can also come across as arrogance.
Ah, yes.
You know, it can come across as arrogance, and this might surprise some of you as listeners, is that if someone starts spouting on about something that you didn't ask, it comes across very badly. It comes across as either you didn't understand them, or that you don't think what they're really interested in is that important. You've got something much more interesting to say or whatever. But actually, it's based on a complete misunderstanding. You think, oh, you know, and I see this in kids all the time with dyslexia, that they go off on a tangent and talk about something. They know lots about dinosaurs. And you said, yeah, that's great. But I was actually asking about what the feet of a stegosaurus might be. What shape are they? And they go, oh, well, you know, there's this and there's that. And no, I just want to know what the shape of a foot of a stegosaurus is.
Yeah.
And if you keep not answering people's questions and you translate that into the workplace, people start going, actually, that's really lovely. You obviously know your stuff, but I need someone who answers my problem or my question accurately, not someone who just knows tons of stuff, but someone who can actually deliver results. And a result is when you answer someone's problem.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? That's a perfect example, isn't it? And it looks like you're not listening, as you said. When we really want, you know, a problem to be solved is this, and we have to solve it. Yeah, I love that. That's perfect.
I mean, there was a podcast episode where I did this with a dentist, the dentist podcast, where he did the dyslexia test before and after. He did a podcast, half the podcast just before his dyslexia assessment and half the podcast after, and how he's feeling before and how he's feeling after. It's fascinating because he's very nervous and he was worried that he would actually be stupid, not just dyslexic. Yeah. You know, I say that because that's his words, not mine. Yeah. That's how he felt. And yeah. He's one of the most intelligent people I know. He's a genius, you know, he's a very gifted individual. Yeah. But the results of going through school with dyslexia is this constant undermining of your confidence to say you're not actually, you're just faking it, you're just getting by, etc. Yeah. Anyway, the point I'm making is that, and he had a really good tip that a lot of people with dyslexia do. And here's a good tip for this. When someone asks you a question, don't answer it straight away.
Yes.
Repeat the question. So what if someone said, oh, you, the Battle of Hastings with the Kings, 1066, you want to know how well prepared they were and who is the best prepared king and why they won? Yeah, that's what I'd like to know. Oh, right. Okay. And what happens is, first of all, you clarify whether you've got the right end of the stick. And second of all, you get time to process the answer. Isn't that clever?
Nicholas had to do an oral exam for his PhD. Nicholas has this auditory processing disorder.
Your son?
My son, Nicholas, yes, who was called the worst child I've seen in 20 years of teaching. He completed a PhD at Oxford. His accommodation was to have a tutor get him, help him prepare for the oral exam. What did they do? Exactly what you said. He practiced, I'm asking you a question. Repeat the question back to me. Is this what you're asking? And it was a critical skill for him that lasts him a lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to develop on that, one of the interesting ways to develop that technique of comprehension of a question is to go on and follow that on and repeat the question again, but this time in your own words. Yes. So for example, you might say the Battle of Hastings 1066. What you're really asking for is what king won and why? And the person goes, yeah, that is what I'm asking for. Okay, right. What king won and why? Well, there were two kings, and the king that won was such and such. And the reason he won was because his men had been well fed and well trained for the 2 weeks before the battle, and the other king had just crossed the channel and insisted on marching them straight there, and they were exhausted and tired. And although they were the better warriors and the bigger army, they lost. So I think the king that won because he was a better leader. And he chose his timing well, and he prepared his men well, even though he had the smaller armor. Now that's an answer to the core question. And if you, I'm not an expert in history or Battle of Hastings, but I know some of the kids do this. So I'm taking it off the kids here. But the point I just made there was, number one, a question was put forward.
Yes.
The threat there is that you misunderstand the question.
Yes.
Which is, oh, tell me all about the Battle of Hastings and what happened. That is not the question. All that time's wasted when you tell them what happened in the Battle of Hastings. Irrelevant. The actual question is what happened before the Battle of Hastings that had an impact on the battle and who won. That's the real question. And then you reiterate the question to make sure you're on track in their words, and then you put it into your words. And if you really want to take it to the next level, you use the word like. So you would say, you could maybe even say, is it like, you know, is it like when we discussed the battle in Rome where you were wondering about this, that, or the Trojan horse or whatever, and the person goes, oh, well, it's not quite like that. It's more like this. And you're like calibrating what the person's actually wanting, and you're going, right, okay, this is what it, and you know, so you're constantly calibrating and zooming in on what the person needs rather than just verbally dumping everything you know about the Battle of Hastings. That's critical thinking put into action combined with comprehension.
Is it like?
And then is it like?
You've really got to get down the it.
Well, that's interesting. Yes, you picked that up, Lois. Is it like the pronoun? Because I use that all the time. When someone's teaching me something and it's abstract, so you could maybe say, Lois, you're teaching me something here about pronouns. And you might say, I might reply back, so are pronouns kind of like masks? You know, so there's the real person, and then you end up not having the person, but maybe a mask. And that's a boy mask or an egg mask or something. And you can switch it in and out and swap it for them. And you don't have to have the actual person there or like a pup, you know. And so what I'm using is I'm saying, is it like? Is it like? And what I'm actually asking of you in that conversation is to help me visualize it in a way that's accurate to what you're saying. Yes. And I don't always get it right, but by posing the question, is it like, you're basically pulling out some feedback from the person you're with. Yes. And calibrating yourself more accurately and getting your feedback from them. So they're actually doing the hard work for you. You're just setting them up to do the work for you by saying, is it like this? Yeah. And they go, no, it's not like that. It's like this, da, 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 da. And you're like, oh, because when the moment you start saying, is it like, and you start picturing in something, that person starts talking in a picture, and pictures are your language of understanding.
Exactly. Totally agree. And, you know, you were talking about pronouns as you get older. I read a paper a long time ago about as you get older, you do use more pronouns because you lose the noun. And you do have to reflect, like you and your wife are talking, you do have to reflect and say, what is it? What are you talking about? And it's a problem as you get older.
I don't understand. Could you explain that to me? So as you get older, you use more pronouns. Why?
Because you forget the noun. You forget what you're talking about.
You forget what you're talking about. So you just say it and they and so on. How can you keep talking about it if you forget what you're talking about? I don't understand that.
Well, that's partly Alzheimer's, isn't it? And then conversations go like this. You're not communicating. You go, oh, you know, two different levels. Maybe the it's are two different things.
Ah, right. Yes.
Because that's the thing about it. You know, even within a paragraph, it will change its meaning depending on the last thing you've read about. And your mask thing is interesting because, yes, that's what we do with pronouns. But you have to follow the talk and the conversation to work out who's the last person we were talking about.
Or yeah. Who's talking.
We use it because we are very lazy with speech and written language. We don't want repetition of the same name again and again and again and again.
Yes.
And skilled writers get it right. And I read something, I can't remember where I was reading it, and I thought, this guy has got the pronoun wrong. He's muddled it up and it becomes confusing. What's he talking about?
Yeah.
So he needed a better editor. But anyway, yes, and what you have said is absolutely right about the questioning and the thinking and is it like, and talking in our language, the language of pictures. And it goes back to that every single word in our language is meaningful. It's not there as an add-on extra, but we are lazy. And we cannot make assumptions about the meaning of words, and particularly pronouns.
Yeah.
Follow it through.
And do you think that maybe people with dyslexia sometimes are a bit guilty of being a bit sloppy with he, they, it, and so on as well? Because maybe that's dyslexia, or maybe that's just me. Because sometimes You know, like my dad sometimes says she when it should be he, and so
Yes.
I, you know what I'm talking about, sort of thing. And sometimes people with dyslexia are can picture what they're doing and they jump straight into something. Like you're in a conversation, and I see this with my daughter a lot. She's highly dyslexic, much more dyslexic than I am. You follow the train of a conversation. You're talking about topic A, topic B, topic C. Topic A is Amazon rainforest. Topic B, coronavirus. Topic C, the jobs market. And you're then talking about the jobs market, and she suddenly starts talking about, you know, there's only 1 inch of soil for them. And you're like, hold on a minute. For people who are working, 1 inch of soil? And you're like, no, for the trees in the Amazon. And you're like, that was two topics ago.
Yes. But I think you said it right at the beginning, the he, she, and they and them, they are abstract words. They are not concrete. And that's what throws dyslexic readers. On top of that, when teachers are teaching these words, they teach them abstractly as opposed to teaching them concretely. The word he is standing in this story in place of. And a book I use is called Dear Zoo by Rod Campbell. It's a common kids book. And it starts off with Dear Zoo. I wrote to the zoo to send me a pet. They sent me an elephant. He was too big. I sent him back. And every other page is, he was too tall, I sent him back. He was too fierce, I sent him back. The he is the same on every single page.
But it means something different on every single page. Wow. Yeah.
I sent him back. Him changes meaning on every single page.
Wow.
The teacher is satisfied the fact that the child's read every word.
Right, yes. Oh, I had a funny pronoun encounter with my 23-year-old daughter yesterday. She had the book of tulips, and she was saying, Dad, do you like this one or do you like that one? And I said, I like that one. And then she said, so you think I should get this one? And I was like, no, I think you should get that one. And she was pointing at the same one. Do you see what I mean? So she immediately flipped the that one to the this one, you know, which is proper English, of course. But immediately that pronoun changed, didn't it? But I made a joke saying, no, not this one, but that one.
Yeah.
Stop calling it this one. It's now that one. And from now on, that tulip will always be called that tulip. So sometimes I need that, you know, to just anchor it and simplify it.
Words like this and that are relative in placement.
Yes.
You know, and we don't teach that. We don't show how that works. We just expect it to happen.
Yeah, and I think I kind of had this childhood kind of like, just let's keep this as that one and that as that one.
And you were teasing.
Yeah, I was.
And having lots of fun with it. We just make too many assumptions about language and its power, and that once we've got it, rather than slowing it down and really reflecting on the meaning of these basic words. Why is this important? The first 100 sight words that we teach are the 50% of all words that we read. The first 300 sight words are in 65% of all the words that we read. We think of vocabulary.
Yeah.
These foundational words are the glue. They tell us all sorts of things that we just assume.
And how many of the first 100 words that are 50% of everything we read for the rest of our lives, how many of those words would you see are pronouns then?
I would guess it's about 10 or 12%, maybe more.
So about 10 to 15 words are pronouns, like they, them, it, her, he, she, that sort of thing. Yes. This is a perfect example, Lois, of slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
Yes.
And sometimes With dyslexia, often with the manual gearbox of our mind, we need to just slow things down so much slower than other people sometimes to break the process down, and then we become automatic. But we never become automatic unless we slow it down and start visualizing it. And this rule becomes universal, whether it's learning to tie your shoelaces, to tell the time, to decode letters, to decode words, to decode the meaning in text, to decode questions, to taking notes, to, you know, giving talks, whatever. Each one of these processes has to be slowed down so that we can manually go through the process rather than the other 70% of the population who can just automatically kick into that gear.
And if you don't slow it down, the absolute foundations of learning to read are like a building. They're crumbling before you even
start. That's right. You're just constantly swimming. There's nothing to put your feet down on, nothing solid. You're constantly improvising, constantly guessing. And, you know, until suddenly you're in the deep end and you can't sort of flap around long enough to keep afloat, and you really need to have a rest, and you sink and drown, and that's normally high school.
Yeah,
exactly. You just can't afford that. You can't afford to be guessing and hoping and wishing for the best. You have to intentionally choose the best, choose to comprehend.
Fascinating discussion.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. Great, Lois. Thank you for sharing that. So where do people find your in-depth article on this?
It is at the International Literacy Association, and you have to be a member to access it. International Literacy Association, it's coming out in The Reading Teacher. And The Reading Teacher is the premier magazine for all teachers.
Okay.
And, you know, it's International Literacy Association, so it's internationally accessible. It's about $30 or $40 a year to join. And if you're a teacher, I think you should read it. And, you know, because I'm dyslexic, I can't write this on my own. I teamed up with Emeritus Professor Tim Rosinski, who did all the detailed stuff that he needed to do to make this article acceptable to The Reading Teacher. But it's there. It'll be coming out in print, I imagine, within the next 12 months. When we did it, we had to go back and look the theory. And one of the things from the theory that struck me is that it said, when we read, when a person reads, you've got no idea what's going on in their mind, and that person creates their own image. And that's the difference, isn't it? And that's what you and I talk about.
Yeah.
And your clarifying questions, is it like, is really good to help you understand what's going on in your mind. Ah, I got this totally wrong. Yeah. I didn't get that. I got this.
Yeah. I think that's why doodling is so useful in this, because if I tell you a story and then I ask you, could you doodle what you think it looks like as I go through the story? Then they're doodling it and they can show you the doodle, and it's fascinating how much more comprehension comes when a child doodles while they listen.
Yes, yes. And you're aiming for comprehension through doodling.
Yes, you're aiming for comprehension. So whenever I teach doodling for note-taking, you know, basically, you know, listen and doodle, or listen and take notes, I don't want them to do drawing.
Yeah.
I want them to do doodling, even if it's I sometimes even get them to take a line on a walk. And so they're not allowed to draw a picture. They just listen to the story, and the line moves according to the gesture of that story at that point. So for example, once upon a time, there was a girl who was hopping and skipping through the forest, and, you know, so the lines kind of hopping and skipping. And then she went into the forest and it was really dark and scary. And then maybe it goes all jaggedy and, you know, and so they go through it. And so that line is completely incomprehensible to someone else who's looking at it. What is that?
Yes.
But to the child who listened to the story, every single section of that line, they're like, oh, that's the forest there. And that's when she met the grandmother. And that's when the wolf came out of the tummy and so on, you know, or the grandmother came out the tummy. And it doesn't matter what the doodle is, as long as the person is using the gesture of the doodle to help them comprehend what they're listening to, then the link is made.
Yeah. Because as I look at my schooling, never was comprehension ever taught.
It was assumed.
It was assumed.
Well, okay, Kenton, that's not completely true, Lois, because we all get comprehension tests would be the argument against that. Well, comprehension is taught. We give children comprehension tests. There you go. How would you argue against that, Lois?
I failed them and no one cared.
Okay. Yes, that's true. Yeah, I agree. You failed them and someone assumed you're just either not reading or you're not caring.
And you're just dumb.
Or you're being lazy or you're not smart enough to figure it out. Yeah.
You know, I can, in my book, there's a chapter on that. You know, the incident that I went through as a kid that still stuck in my mind of doing comprehension tests, we had to mark them. And either the teacher didn't care that I failed, but boy, I worked so hard on that to fail.
Yes.
And no one helped me. Ever.
Yes. And that book is reversed, a memoir, isn't it? We'll put a link in the description. Yeah. We'll also put a link in the description towards where they can find your article.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, if you do a dyslexia test, the formal one with a psychologist, they often give you a reading passage as a comprehension test with some questions. I did that and I was surprised that I got two of the questions wrong, and it was just a simple children's story. And I read it three times. And I was quite surprised by that because I skipped some minor details which I thought were just irrelevant to the main story, which they were. But the comprehension test wanted you to identify those details. And I didn't realize that's what they were wanting. So that's one of the challenges with comprehension as well, is, you know, what are you meant to comprehend? Because, you know, you can read. I remember going to university and the lecturer would say to me, when you read a book, we don't want you to understand everything in that book or ever understand the or read the whole book. We just want you to find the key parts in the book that are relevant to what you're learning right now or what the question at hand is. So you have to go into reading with a question before you start reading to fully comprehend it. And sometimes the children are trying to understand absolutely everything in the text, but actually you're not trying to understand everything in the text. You're understanding the core thing that's meant to be understood. Some of it is just a little bit of flourish, you know?
We're coming to the end of it. It's why when I teach children, I pull out the dialogue and read it as a play.
Okay.
So that you're getting rid of the description and the added extra flourishes that the author has put on. This is the main idea.
Yeah.
This is what's happening in this chapter.
Yes.
So it makes it easier to understand. And then because you're reading it as a dialogue, you're getting the comprehension of you're not only saying that, how would you say it? And why would you say it in that way? And that's where the comprehension comes through reading. You know, at a deeper level.
Yeah.
You're not just
absolutely
saying these words.
Absolutely. I mean, even on a higher level here, for example, comprehension. In English, sometimes you get given a picture and you're told to describe it. You know, describe this picture, do a descriptive essay of this picture. Okay. So let's say I gave you a picture of a road and it's a pathway with hedges and so on. And I was thinking about this. When you ask a person with dyslexia to describe that road, you know, the person with dyslexia is like, well, you know, that's a very big question. You know, do you want me to describe the history of how this road came into being? Do you want me to describe the geology of the rock that is here, or do you want me to start describing, you know, the structure of the hedges and there's so many different levels of description. What do you mean precisely? You know, and the person was like, no, I just wanted you to describe that it is a road and it goes from here to there and lots of cars drive on it and sometimes pedestrians do. That was it. Well, why didn't you say that? And so, you know, comprehension happens on multiple levels through multiple lenses. And the interesting thing with a person with a dyslexic mind is often viewing the world with a much wider angled view, often through different lenses as well. You know, I'm looking at this as a structural engineer or as an ecologist or as a whatever with that kind of mindset.
There's a lot of work coming out about the importance of looking at it through these different lenses, through a piece of writing. How would a scientist view this piece of writing? How would a mathematician view it? How would a photographer view it? You know, so you're reading the same piece through different lenses.
Just wow. Yes, yes. And so you'd have a different set of comprehension questions at the end.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why, just as a little hack for any of you parents or teachers that are listening, that I would teach my students in the Bullet Map Academy is that before you read the comprehension, read the questions.
Yeah. What are they asking?
Because the moment you start reading the questions, you become like a sniffer dog. You get given the scent. And as you're reading through the story, you're starting to sniff out the path of what they're looking for. Rather than having to scan everything for what they potentially might be looking for, you go straight to what the person wants. And so that comes all the way back to asking or understanding the question.
What is it like?
What is it like? Or what do you want? And in fact, actually, I think sometimes on a more metaphysical level, instead of looking for the right answer, we should be looking for the right question, because the right question always leads you to the right answer. If you're not asking the right question, you end up with the wrong answers. Yeah. And so often effort spent in clarifying your questions, like I remember someone saying, you know, what's my purpose in life? They said, no, that's the wrong question to ask. The better question to ask is, who's my purpose in life? Because the moment you find your who, you find your why, and you find your what. So often asking the right question is the key piece of work that needs to be done. That all comes back to comprehension too. Anyway, that was very metaphysical, wasn't it, Lois?
You know, comprehension, reading without comprehension as I grew up is disastrous.
Yes. Disastrous. Yes. I mean, something we've not talked about is reading without comprehension. Now, our last podcast when we were talking about this is I have so many students who have done Orton Gillingham or the Barton Reading Program and so on. And to their credit, they teach them how to read. But within their terms and conditions, they're very clear. They're like, we will teach your child how to read, but we don't teach reading comprehension because that is another level. Because, you know, reading comprehension is important, but to have reading comprehension, you need to be able to decode the words. And so they need to go ideally hand in hand, but sometimes you need to slow down to decode the word and then go into the gear of reading comprehension. And I'm not going to get into, I think these reading programs are really very helpful. It's helpful to be intentional, full stop. And I know you've got different opinions on different programs. We'll not get into that. But what I want to get into with the listeners just briefly is how useful it is for children to underline keywords as they're reading through text. Yes.
And visualize.
Yes.
And visualize and clarify. So what did you say? Underline keywords.
Yeah.
Visualize, clarify.
Yes.
Particularly when you're answering questions for exams.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've got people who are adults, they're lecturers, they're doctors, and I've gone through this process where I get them to brainstorm their ideas as a bullet point list before we turn it into a map. That's why we're called Bullet Map Academy. We've got a bullet list, then a map. So we do the bullet list, and then what I get them to do is, on their own thoughts, I say, we've got a bullet point list of four keywords, four words that you've written down here, or you've thought. I just want you to underline two of those words that are slightly more important. And if they're dyslexic, they will find it very hard.
You're evaluating words too, you know, and you're seeing the subtlety of meaning. And that's what it, you know, when you do things about reading comprehension, they say, my mind's gone blank, that every time you read it, there's shades of words.
Shades? What do you mean?
Oh, that one word doesn't have the exact meaning every time.
That meaning
changes, you know, and there's a subtlety in language that comes out as you get better and better use of the language. Have you ever watched Tolkien, the movie?
Oh, I don't know if I have, actually.
It's brilliant.
Why?
You know Tolkien.
Yes, I love him. Yeah.
I don't. But
I love his work. What do you mean you don't?
I don't love his work. I can't read it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. But the movie, and I mean, I admire what he's done. No question about it. I absolutely admire what he's done. But it's about Tolkien, and he meets a professor in Oxford, Joseph Wright, and Joseph Wright talks about words, and Joseph Wright is a philologist who study a studier of words, and it's fascinating how he describes words as having these subtleties of meaning in them.
Uh-huh.
And that only comes over time. That's when you start with it, you only see one picture of a word. But as you become a better and better reader, the words are coloured. Words are coloured. And there's a reason for that. I mean, the skilled readers understand those subtleties better than the ones who are struggling.
Yeah, and the way to start understanding those subtleties, if you are struggling, is to slow down and start asking some questions of yourself intentionally. Like, what is it? Well, Lois, that is fantastic. Thank you very much for being on the podcast. Links in the show notes below. Thanks for coming back on.
Thank you for having me. It's fantastic.
Great. See you later, guys. Bye. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.